Good morning. I'm Jeff Kell. I'm the Director of Network Services at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. We are the blue and gold UT, not the big orange one. A little bit about our network, very quickly. We're not a huge school. We're not a real small school. We're sort of in the middle. About 20,000 wired ports, almost 600 switches and routers, 350 wireless access points and growing. Have lots of registered MAC addresses. We're in the process of doing network admission and registration. 17,000 registered, still got 4,000 that aren't. Well, if I can stay close to here, okay. It'll work. Sorry. And of course, we are a state institution, so budget-wise, we only have six FTE to run all of this. We've got two on ENG, three with tech fee, and one with stimulus money that we don't know if we're going to be able to keep it. So we're busy folks. A little bit of the agenda. Why would you want to virtualize? Or why would you want to do VRFs? Just a kind of quick show of hands. Is anybody doing VRF today? Got one in the back. Thinking about it, maybe, possible. Got a couple more. I want to do a quick overview of what a VRF is. I'll show you one proof of concept example that we did on campus just to see if this was going to work. Go over some of the design challenges that you'll run into if you're going to implement this. A little bit of network evolution, how we got to the point of splitting our network into different VRFs, and some of the methods we use to implement this. We basically have done a driving down the freeway at 70 miles an hour and changing a flat tire. We've done it online, more or less. So, virtual routing, really? You know, isn't this just one big happy network? IPv6 is coming along that promises point-to-point, anywhere, anytime, any place. We're all on the net. We had some legacy closed systems that have evolved over time. 20 or 30 years ago, you had lots of devices like this on your network or on a network. They may be plugged into a little hub in somebody's office and never connected to the internet. They were never designed to be out in the wild open. But we have, of course, the trendy open systems, all your web, email, portals, remote desktop access for those that should have it, webcams, security cameras. So if we take all of these closed systems that people have traditionally thought were private, along with open systems, add a little mobile access, which is the big thing these days. It's not just laptops. You've got smartphones and everything else that are trying to connect to your network. You add a little plug and pray. There's all these discovery protocols that want to jump out on the network and find other devices on the network that it might want to communicate with. IPv6 is very bad about this. It wants to spread out advertisements about, I'm your router, I'm your router, I'm your router. Printers will announce themselves with their queue names. So you take all of this together and mix really well. In the top case, you may be mixing it intentionally. In the bottom case, the little Pink Floyd there, you may be mixing them by brute force. But when we get all of these things mixed together, does this look familiar, like a chunk of your network? We have all sorts of disparate devices with different security levels, with different responsibilities, with different types of access, just sitting on the network. There are a lot of cases we ran into of people calling and our door access panel is not working. And I'm, what door access panel? We plugged it in the network 5 years ago. Haven't had trouble with it since. What's this thing doing? It controls access to the dorm rooms. Well, it's on the same subnet as the dorm student lab. Do you think this is a good thing? Then you can get into compliance with PCI standards, which tells you that you must do some things in terms of network separation, specifically that RFC 1918. You need to be doing private addressing. It's IP masquerading. And you have to have stateful inbound and outbound filtering. How do you do that with one device that's in the middle of this huge cloud? Start getting some really ugly access lists if you're going to try to do that on a common network. So sort of what we would like to have high in the sky, we'll get all of our users with the same type of needs, and all of our services with the same type of needs, all of our special devices, the wireless printers, mobile phones, security cameras, any of these other things, to be able to identify them and keep them on a common network. And we'd be able to duplicate this in different buildings in our campus, or duplicate them in different routed nodes around your network. There was this recurring theme among the security provisions, in that you want to minimize the visibility of these devices. PCI is very strict about this. It has to be on a 1918 address, not routable to the internet. You want to minimize the exposure. You know, which services do you really want to open up? And one a little more subtle, you need to try to minimize the advertisements. There are lots of devices out there that will just constantly say who they are, where they are, how they connect. Anybody with Windows, if you connect, every 60 seconds it's going to announce its SMB name to the world. You can sit and sniff these on any wireless network. So, the original security model, you've probably seen this before, it's a Tootsie Pop. Put a perimeter firewall on the outside, maybe have some border access ACLs, maybe you switch the order of those two, but that's protecting our perimeter. So that's hard on the outside and generally soft and chewy on the inside. You don't really know what happens once it gets inside. So perhaps the more updated model in recent years, they talk about doing security by layers. So we'll have perimeter firewall, perimeter IPS, border router ACLs. When we get down to the server farm, we'll put up another firewall, maybe another IPS. And when we get down to the host, we'll have a host-level IDS or a host-level firewall, IP tables and all your hosts, which is good. You've added some layers. But perhaps the more appropriate model, this is a little bizarre, would be the garlic, which is sort of similar to an onion. But we have a common root of public services that everybody's going to need. That's your web, mail, those types of things. The core is divided into little cloves of functionality. If you have people on your campus doing digital signage, and they have their own little servers and their own little kiosk boards, those things probably don't need to talk to anything else. And if students have access to them, they may want to put up their own little messages that you don't want on those boards. We had the little demo yesterday about Googling around and finding open cameras and phones that are on the network just because they were publicly addressable. The guy pulled up a, had the last calls and missed calls and everything else from somebody's IP phone out there somewhere. You know, these things happen. But with the garlic model, you have these little cloves of people doing different things. And they're relatively independent, but you do need some kind of a common stem of infrastructure. Everybody's got to have DHCP. They all have to have DNS. They all have to have a default route to the internet somewhere. So with a typical separation model that's common among EDUs, you may take your ResNet traffic and essentially separate it from your campus traffic. If you share outside connectivity, they've got to come together at some point. But with some access controls, you can kind of keep those separate. So it's the two networks that you're dealing with. If you need campus going straight to dorms, you can put your own little firewall or access list in there to tell them what they can do. But in the real world, once you repeat that process, this was a little diagram that came off of our old legacy core router. The little router is over on the far side, and every routed interface that it was supporting is one of the little leaves around this circle. So once you get more than just campus and ResNet, when you start going faculty, staff, student, labs, you've got all these other special purpose things around, you have lots of subnets. And each time you add a new one, you've got new access controls to consider, okay, now who can get into here? And where is this supposed to go? And the number of connections you have to consider grow geometrically. But VRFs looked like a pretty good answer at the time. In a nutshell, where we've got layer two VLANs in a traditional network, you may take similar things and put them on a common VLAN, which at least for in terms of broadcast traffic and sniffing, that's a big improvement because you can only sniff on the same layer two network where you are. You've got unique MAC address tables for each of those VLANs. The interconnections are usually managed by a router, whether you do it with a switched virtual interface or you have an external router that does it. If you want to link buildings together carrying these layer two VLANs, usually do a trunk. But now with virtual routing, it's another step above. Rather than the multiple physical switches that we're emulating multiple physical routers. Each VRF has its own layer three routing table. So not only do you have different MAC address tables that never see each other, you have different routing tables. It's a whole other thing with the layer two. When you mesh together at a core, each one has a routed interface. You've got routes to everybody. Whether the access controls actually let you get there or not is another story, but it's fully meshed at all times. And if you drop an ACL, you forget an ACL, you mix up an ACL, maybe you've allowed some exposure that you wouldn't have otherwise. With VRF, if they're separate routing tables, you don't have a route to the destination network, you're not going to get there. But connecting these VRFs are typically managed by what they call a provider edge router. I'll show you a little quick diagram of the MPLS type setup here. The provider edge is the one that's responsible for possibly routing between VRFs and handling all the different VRFs. How do we link these up together? There's a couple of ways. The easy and low budget method of doing this, you can just do a trunk. The other way is to do tunneling, if you have the hardware that supports tunnels, or you can go with MPLS. And MPLS is the very complicated, very expensive version of doing VRFs, which we did not do. If you have the money and the time to do that, please feel free. Again, with the VPNs, and this is, no, it's not the little thing you click on when you're off campus when you want to get on campus. This is actual virtual private networks. So we can have a VPN number one over here, VPN number two. It could be completely different layer three domains, or they could even be use the same IP ranges if you want to do that. It's very bizarre, but you can. And then you go through some routed infrastructure and pop out at another building. This may be a remote campus. But you've duplicated the VLAN VPN one on the other end. If you do MPLS and some other tricks, you can run layer two across to a remote campus. Cisco has a little diagram of what they think VRF should be. I stole this from one of their slides. You have engineering, finance, and contractors, and never the three shall mix. But you have engineering, finance, and contractors in different buildings on the industrial campus. So the way they keep those separate is using VRFs toward the core. And then they all fight over the one common internet connection down there at the bottom. But rather than Cisco, a more practical example and sort of where I got started, I have to put up the copyright credit slide. But at the EDUCAUSE SBC conference, or the equivalent thereof, in 2007, Robert Neal from VCU did a presentation on virtualizing your network, divide and conquer. I so wanted to steal that title again, but he'd taken it. And one of the slides he presented was what they had done at VCU. So here was a university that was really doing this, and it was really working for them. He had a lot of good metrics about how many access control rules they had eliminated by going to VRS, and how their firewall rules were decreasing exponentially. But basically, they had voice and admin data that they needed spread around across different buildings. They have labs, which is the orange part here. Their network services IT guys had their own VRF. And then close to the top was their internet connectivity. So, this is possible. But what do we need to do it with? If I can go back to that just 1 minute. Previous. When I looked at this diagram, I counted 13 Cisco 6500s, which was way out of our budget. And they are running the actual MPLS. You know, this is a very bulletproof, very straightforward approach. But I thought, is there any other way to do this on a better budget? So from the distribution, there are a couple of options how you're going to connect things. With VRF Lite, you just needed some kind of dedicated VLAN where you do the point-to-point connections on a trunk. You don't need any particularly special hardware. I'm going to use some Cisco examples here because that's what we use on campus for layer 3, but all the way down to 3550s we'll do this. The other way to connect VRFs is with tunnels, GRE tunnels, if you've used some of those. A lot of people are doing with VPNs. So rather than trying to send the traffic over a trunk or MPLS, you set up a GRE tunnel between one endpoint and the other endpoint and just let it pass through. You don't have to advertise the routes on either end. And then finally, the true MPLS, which is where rather than a trunk, you can really do a point-to-point and then tag all your VRFs. Stop me if I'm going too fast. Questions are open. Hardware requirements. This is a little more specific. When you get to layer 2, once you get to what VLAN are we going to put a user on, it doesn't really matter what you use. Anything that can do layer 2 and supports a trunk uplink can be a VRF switch. Basically, all you do is you take the VLANs that are present in the building, you decide which VRFs they belong to, and that once you have them allocated, it's magic. The building uplink that's handling the VRFs has to identify, map those VRFs into VLANs, but otherwise it's just a VLAN. Layer 3 switches that support more than one VRF require at least VRF Lite, which is one of the Cisco deals, which, skip to the bottom line, means you have to have an EMI services license for that switch. It'll add $2,000 to $8,000 to the price of the switch to be able to do the EMI license, or what they call IP services these days. Normally they ship these things with IP base. They'll do RIP and that's about it. But with IP services, you get the full nine yards. Older Catalyst switches do not like to do VRFs very well. We didn't have any trouble with our 4500s. The 6500, the legacy core, had an old Supervisor 2 in it. On Supervisor 2, you can assign a physical interface to a VRF, but you can't do a switch virtual interface to a VRF. SUP 720s will do that, Whether the 32s will do, I don't know. I don't have a case example to try. But if you want to test your particular platform, just go into configuration mode and say IPVRF question. It'll either say, I don't know what that command is, or you'll get the syntax. So the first step was to try to do a proof of concept example for something that showed that this was possible and not just a crazy idea that I had one Friday afternoon. We have in our engineering building, computer science has this advanced network lab. What they wanted for the advanced network lab was an unfiltered raw feed from the internet so they could see all the malicious traffic and things that go probing around. They were going to be doing virus research in this lab, and this lab was in the EMCS building, which I did not have a straight path to get them out of the network to the edge where they couldn't hurt anybody. The old way we did this was took a couple of phone pairs we got from telecom services and basically gave them a T1 into our edge so that they really were a separate little network. We had trouble with the T1, particularly we lost one of the routers that was doing the T1. So the next step up was, hey, let's take the building distribution switch, which was a 4500, and we'll create a VRF on it for the virus lab. So all we have to do is keep the virus lab network separate, and then I need to tunnel it out to the edge so it doesn't see the campus. So that's the way this was actually done. What used to be a T1 was now a GRE tunnel. It shouldn't actually be going up and over to the edge. It's actually coming through the regular network infrastructure, but it's on a dedicated VLAN. It really does work. They had a small subnet that they were using, which was public IPs, and that had to be hidden from campus. So if you go into that building distribution and you look at the legacy routes in there, there's no sign of that public network that they're using. But if you show the IP routes for VRF EMCS lab, you do see their 74 subnet. And if you look at the default route out of the EMCS lab, it's pointing to that tunnel. So anywhere on campus when you show IP routes, you never see the 74. It's nowhere to be found. So how are we going to do this on a bigger scale? Real quick evolution of the network at UTC. It may resemble a lot of other ones. We started out with one router in the core in the data center, and you start running switches out where you need people connected. Switches if you were lucky, hubs if you weren't, but everybody just plugged in and we're a big happy family and stuff happens. Well, that worked for most cases. We did have concerns about faculty and staff and the records office and the admissions office and people like that that were dealing with student records. So we had an actual air-gapped network. They had their own switches, and we'd have another uplink out to the building where these offices were. But that wasn't going to scale up that well if we had to repeat that for every building. This is about the time Cisco was promising, oh, we're going to do trunking. You can do multiple VLANs on a single switch. So we said, fine, let's do that. So we created some networks for different user types, whether it's faculty, students, staff. And they plugged into their switches on the end. You ran it to the core. The core routes those different little VLANs. And everybody was a happy camper for a while. Then you get more and more buildings, more and more users. You get a couple of thousand people on one flat layer 2 VLAN broadcast domain, and things start to fall apart. So some buildings were so big, we thought, well, rather than do this, will stick some routers out there. And we'll still do the VLANs, but then we'll do a little point-to-point back to our core. This is typically what you'll see when you have a remote campus or a remote location that you need to run over the public internet or whatever, so that you can reduce it to a simple point-to-point link. That did work, but what we were really after with the VRF approach is you want virtual routers, one for each of these groups. So the red, green, and blue never cross by default. That's the way VRFs work. It doesn't mean you have to buy three routers in the core. This is one physical device, but three logical instances. A couple of challenges to VRFs. A few of many. You need a general template that you're going to build these things from. The first one is always the hardest, and then after that, you just kind of copy and paste, and they sort of work. The second problem is, how do you get started? If you've got this traditional network that we were just looking at, or worse still, if you have that big cloud of all kinds of mixed devices, how do you start? We have to deal with external connectivity. For all these VRFs, they've got to have a way to get to the internet. And when the traffic comes back, we've got to make sure it goes back into the right VRF. You need some internal connectivity to your common services, DNS, DHCP, NTP, these kind of things. Everybody's going to have to talk to those. And then, in spite of our best plans, there are going to be some special exceptions for, well, this guy's over in this VRF, and he's minding his own business, but he really, really, really needs to touch this one over here. So you have to make cases for those firewall exceptions and keep them to a minimum, hopefully. Ours are still small. I'll have faith for it. Addressing conventions that we used, and this is not necessarily something you have to keep, but this kind of applies to later slides. In our new network, we just used RFC 1918 across the board. We do NAT at the edge. But being able to use that, we could use some addressing schemes that made a lot more sense to look at. So we basically took the 10 range, and within 10, we're sort of 10.building.VRF/VLAN, which one do you belong to in that building, and then the host. So that gave us some numbering schemes for each of the buildings or routed nodes. And then up in the high range of 10s, we said, all right, we're going to have something to replace those point-to-point links that we had before. You had the core, and then you do a little point-to-point routed thing, the little slash 30 trick that goes out to all your routed nodes. That wasn't going to work so well with VRF trunks. So we took some of the upper range of 10s, and those were going to be our backbones for these VRFs. Each VRF is going to need one thing for its backbone to replace that point-to-point link. So which way do you do it? There's the point-to-point or the ring. You can go point-to-point with MPLS, but it's pretty expensive. If you try to do it with a routed interface on a Cisco, you know, Cisco, it can be a switch port or a routed interface. If it's routed, it can only do one network, at least on the catalysts. If you try to do the sub-interfaces, the interface GO1.100 to be its tagged 100 going out, it doesn't like that. Upper-end routers can, catalysts can't. So we chose just a switch virtual interface with the trunks going out. What this looks like is you take 224.1 being our backbone network for the global routing, and for each one connected to it, they're on the same subnet, but they have their own unique IP addresses. This way, you can have, if you chose VLAN 800 to carry this around, it's VLAN 800 going everywhere you want to go. If you did this point-to-point, the Corps is going to need a VLAN 800 and 801 and 802 and 803 to go to all these different buildings. And you've got to remember on the other building end, what number is this, what number is this, what number is this? If you just make them all 800, put them on the same little 24, everybody's happy. But if you have multiple rings, you've got different fiber distribution areas, it's a good place to do aggregation. You can still do the same with your core there on the left. The new one that you're adding on the right can have a different 24. And where you want to interconnect them, you can give them an interface on both. So you can have some redundancy, you can have some failover. If you, depending on your routing call protocols, you may be able to load balance those links. Buys you a little more time. So getting back to how do we get the legacy network into this? We basically take the legacy network, open up one more little interface. It's going to be the VLAN over to our new, shiny new VRFPE core. Initially, all you have to bring over is the one VLAN for the legacy network. So we're going to skip the slide. All right. So once we make this connection, we've got to define the VRF inside the new router. The template for VRF, you give it a name and some kind of routing distinguisher. The name can be anything you want. The route distinguisher, there's two different types that you'll see in examples. One is where you put your autonomous system number first, and then you have a 16-bit identifier second. Some of the Cisco examples use the 32-bit IPv4 address of the router followed by the identifier. If you're looking at possibly doing MPLS down the road, using the ASN colon this identifier is the best way to go, because if you're doing external routing, if you've played with BGP and route communities, what you're actually doing is tagging these VRF routes with a route community. What we've used is RASN followed by a little VRF identifier. And we use the same identifier number as the VLAN number for the backbone, as well as the autonomous system number for whatever protocol is routing that VRF internally. You'll see that again in a minute. So here we are bringing the trunk over from legacy. We define a VRF called legacy, gave it a routing distinguisher, which is the 14209, that's our ASN. Why blur it? You can look it up on your errand. And 810 was going to be our legacy network. So to bring that in, I need an interface, VLAN 810, and then add that IPVRF forwarding legacy. So that means that this interface now belongs to the legacy VRF. And I give it its IP address. So we've got it connected to our legacy network over here. Now I've got to get the routes for it. So whichever routing protocol you're using, in these examples we're doing EIGRP, where you would normally define the router EIGRP, you put in an address family specification for the VRF you're bringing in. So here it's IPv4, the VRF name is legacy. The routing process ID on our legacy network was just one, because we only had one. And I give it the network address of that trunk we ran over to legacy. And we're essentially done. Make sure that VLAN talks to both places. You should see a neighbor routing come up, and then you can show IP route VRF legacy on here, and bingo, there's your legacy network. So you've got connectivity to all the legacy network. But with that done, what's the next step? I showed before where we had the layer two. You do the hub and spoke, you put route everything at the core and just put switches out there. Then we had some cases where, well, we'll route the building and repeat the VLANs out there. Some of those routed buildings we had done with point-to-point links. So we had to go back and convert those back over to trunks so we would be able to add these new ones. So once we have that trunk between the new PE router and legacy, you want to take the VRF backbone VLANs over to legacy. As long as you don't route anything on legacy, you can plumb these VLANs over there as if they were still connected. So the two options there basically is whichever uplink you have from legacy out to the new building, you can extend the VRF backbone VLANs up there and then define your local routing. Or depending on how old the switch was that was in the buildings, we just put in a new uplink router in the building. In the latter case, you can connect it back to your new PE. In the former case, it's still going to be connected to your legacy core until you get rid of the legacy VLANs. Once you get the things in the building set up that you want, as long as your new VLANs don't overlap with your old legacy VLANs, it's just a matter of moving the users, the ports, the devices over to the new network. When the old one is gone, you can disconnect it and move your uplink to the new PE and you're done. Sounds easy, but it's a little weird. So, how do we get between VRFs? There's a couple of ways of doing this. If you want one VRF to be completely meshed with another VRF, you can do this. That's by import-export. That's the little PE connectivity that I've got in the middle. For those few exceptions where you want just this host to talk to just this server, but they're on different VRFs, you're going to have to come up with some kind of a firewall solution to accommodate that. The typical solution you'll see is using a firewall services module that plugs into your, like 6500 support those. They make good PE routers. But with the firewall services module, you can bring all the VRFs into it as straight interfaces and then use its very picky rules about which ones do you let communicate with which other sides. To do the import and export, you'll see this in a lot of Cisco examples, and they will show you this part, which the idea is if I have UTC services, which is my common services, it has DNS, DHCP, and those sorts of things in it, and I have a VRF for dorms, dorms are going to have to talk to my DNS servers, and they've got to be able to answer back to the dorms, so I need to get those routes meshed somehow. When you define that VRF for UTC services, there's a little catch there. It says route target import 802. 802 is the dorm descriptor. Likewise, the dorms are going to import 910, which is my UTC services at the top. So basically, they're going to exchange routes. And it looks really good on paper, and you go home in your lab, and you configure this, and you run it, and it doesn't do squat. There is a little undocumented thing. Well, I won't say undocumented. The school of hard knocks. What makes this actually work is BGP. You have to run BGP on this router before import exports will work at all. It doesn't have to be BGP like you do with your peers. This is just an internal BGP process. It's not going to peer with anybody. Its sole function is to handle this import-export and tagging of the VRF routes. What that looks like, you define the BGP instance, and then for each of these VRFs, what routes do you want exported into here? So in our case, we're going to do anything connected to this router as well as anything I learned EIGRP from my neighbors in the same VRF. We do the same thing in dorms. We're going to redistribute the routes we learned from our peers to EIGRP and redistribute anything connected. Once you get these in place, then yes, everything will show up as you expect. And when you show IP route VRF UTC services, there'll be some native ones, and some of them will say VRF dorms, so you know where they go. But they are considered directly connected at that point. If you don't want to route the entire VRF to the other VRF, you want to do just a few things. Maybe just DNS and DHCP, but I don't want you talking to my mail server. You can either do an import map, which is like a route map, except you can specify which prefixes you want to accept. The other route is when you redistribute BGP like we did earlier, instead of redistributing our entire internal routing protocol, you can use a route map to specify which of those you're going to leak in. Edge connectivity. This is kind of a mess, but this is essentially what we've ended up with. And no, these are not all physical routers. These are VRF instances. The different little colors down here are roughly physical routers. But once all of the VRFs are terminated, we run into a pair of switches that aggregates all of our internet traffic. From there, we've got a Procera that does packet shaping. We've got tipping points. And finally, some Cisco ASA firewalls before we get to the edge. Am I running late? The double lines here is the dual connectivity. We've got a looking at trying to get redundant paths everywhere. But with the edge, we're using ASAs. And they're in active-active failover mode, which basically one side runs campus, the other side runs dorms and wireless traffic. And when you're running active-active mode, you can't do any routing protocols. So we have to have some ugly static routes in the ASAs. But they're also not VRF aware. So if I run all these VRFs up in the ASA, what's stopping the traffic from just backhauling out and returning to the other VRFs anyway? There's a little checkbox, ASA configuration. By default, if you set interfaces to the same security level, it will not allow traffic between those two interfaces. So what we do is bring all the VRFs into the ASA with the exact same security level. So there's no backwash back down those links. Same trunk that we were using before, you get a trunk with one VLAN for each VRF, goes up, feeds into the ASA. There is no backhaul there. So now that you're going out to the internet, there is only one outside interface that we're using now. You could do multiples if you wish. But the important part is that prevents that backhaul. The other consideration, since we're using network address translation, we have to worry about getting all our private addresses into something public on the outside. If you did this strictly on a VRF basis, you could get a pool of outside IP addresses for every VRF you want to do. There are some cases where you want to do that. If you've got your ITD staff people that need a predictable or semi-static outside IP range, you can do that for a VRF. But otherwise, it doesn't care if you share the pool. You can just have one big fat one and everybody uses it. The ASA manages the traffic going back to the parent VRF on the inside once the return traffic comes back. You go out, you pick an address out of the pool, you go out. When it comes back, it's using the same path. So that saves a lot of address space and overhead trying to get those outside pools set up. We have the two primary contacts in RASAs. Again, that was the Dorman Wireless and the main campus. I have seen some cases where people with large licenses on their ASAs will do a separate context for each VRF. If you do that, you have to be careful about incoming traffic. Well, that's really not going to be very visible. I was trying to give you what the ASA saw of our incoming traffic. And these are all of the dotted interfaces down at the bottom where the VRFs are coming in. Our outside interfaces are at the top. But it has no problem dealing with the trunked input side, the trunked inside interface. Takes a little getting used to if you're just used to inside, outside, and DMZ, but it does work. And when you look at the ASA, you can get some statistics based on which VRF is talking to. That part over on the right with the interface status, you can get the traffic rate for those. I couldn't get it to fit more than five or six into the window, so that's all I could get at the moment. But you can scroll down through there and get the rest of them. We'll run these trunks through our Procera. The Procera doesn't care about the trunk traffic, but it can take advantage of that fact that it's a trunk traffic. You can classify or shape traffic based on the VLAN tag. So if you know which VRF it's coming from, you can do some shaping rules. Give this guy priority. Give this guy no priority. We're also running these trunks through our tipping point 1400s. You can do virtual segmentation in the tipping point, defining traffic by VLAN. So doing it by VLAN to us is by VRF. So if you have specific rules you want to apply to one of the VRFs, you can do it there. We still run Snort. We have some Bro boxes configured that I haven't quite got working yet, but any kind of spans that you're doing off of this traffic are going to work just as well. If you span it to a non-trunk destination port, it'll strip the tags for you and you can still snort away on this traffic. If you want to see the VLAN tags for whatever reason, define the destination of the span as a .1Q trunk and you'll keep the tags. One fatal gotcha. Everybody that tries VRFs, create a new one, give it a little interface, and then try to ping their regular old global loopback address, and it just won't work. And there's a recurring thread that comes up in all the Cisco news groups. How do I route from global into VRF? How do I route from a VRF into global? The bottom line is, you basically can't unless you have the very newest iOS on the most expensive real router platforms. They don't let you do that for some reason. But for that reason, primarily, we made a decision to keep that global routing table, the thing that's not any VRF, but just the global routing table for your routers. We only use for management and infrastructure. That's just us. There's no serious user traffic in there whatsoever. Everything else is in VRFs. If it's in a VRF, you can handle VRF to VRF just fine. But getting into global and getting back out of global is a major pain. We do it with the firewall services module. Before we got the firewall services module, I was guilty of using a cable from one port to another, and this port was global and this port was me. There are some ugly workarounds. You can do some static routes depending on your setup. If you've got dual cores, you can go global to VRF as long as the next hop is on another device. It won't let you have a next hop local. So you can route it one way over here and then route it the other way over here. It's not very elegant, but it does work. So this is a list of VRFs that we have currently active at the university. Again, we didn't really take this idea very seriously until that Robert Neal Educall's presentation 4 years ago, and today we are one. So. Questions, comments, snarky remarks?
Did you look at it like instead of using the firewall service model, did you look at anything else internally, maybe something that's recommended or MPS internally?
We had an...
Can you repeat the question?
Did he use anything, did he consider using anything other than the firewall services module, such as like a PAL left or something that would do threat prevention and IPS as well as firewall policy?
And considering other devices other than the firewall services module. You could do this with most any kind of firewall device. Most of them at this point are not VRF aware. So what you're essentially going to get is a feed from each VRF. You have to be careful that you don't let them talk to each other than what you specifically want to carry over. I have seen cases where they will do firewall services module with multiple contexts, one for each VRF. So then you do have just an inside and outside, and they use the DMZ for their common services. Before we got the firewall services module, we had an old PIX 515 that talked to a little switch, had 8 ports on it. And we put the 8 ports on a common subnet and ran a VRF link up from each one. It was very ugly, but it worked until we got the firewall services module. Any others? Okay.
We have a question here in the back.
Yes.
How long did it take you to do this?
How long did it take us to do this? Again, the most of the start was seeing Robert Neal's presentation in 2007 here at Educause SBC. It took some funding. We were going to replace our Core 6500 anyway. So when we brought the new one in, rather than just move everything over and leave it as it stood, we did the VRF prototyping there to see if, is this really going to work. We retired the legacy 6500 about 18 months ago. We still have some legacy networks present, so we're still in the process of doing this move. But with our very small staff and our very small budget and finding the time to do this while still putting out the other fires that come up in day-to-day operation, it's taken us quite a while. But we are close to our conclusion now. We do have VRFs in every building on campus now, with one or two exceptions. Yes? Okay, for routing protocols, did we go from RIP to OSPF to BGP to other things? Our legacy network was using OSPF originally. We had a few issues with that. The main reason that legacy before OSPF was RIP. That was so long ago, I didn't think I had to mention it. What we were looking at with the new one, where I was showing the core, where you could have multiple rings, multiple links between these nodes, there are all kinds of options there. If you do multiple point-to-points, you've got to define the interfaces on both ends. If you do a layer two ether channel and just let it go that way. It will work, but does that really load balance all the time? EIGRP we picked for the new network because it's the only protocol that takes the link load into the metrics to make the decisions. If you have two links available and one of them is running at 80% utilization, it's going to pick the other one. That's what we've used internally. But since the legacy was on OSPF, we had to start up a little routing process for EIGRP and redistribute things in the VAT to be able to bring it over to the new PE router. We've also played a limited extent with RIP. The firewall services module doesn't like to do a lot of routing either. It's not VRF aware, at least not our version. They may have fixed that, but one of the few routing protocols it would speak was RIP. So we actually have the core doing RIP version 2 passively to everybody else except the firewall services module. So each VRF announces all the routes to the firewall services module, but it never announces anything back. And the other catch there is the ASAs are our default route, the 0000, but we take the RFC 1918 blocks and default those pointing at the firewall services module. So that covers any potential VRF to VRF. Yes? Okay, why did we do the RFC 1918? Our original IP allocations way back when came from Surinet at the time, and the ones that we were given were not public portable ranges. I'm not sure that I get the purchasing order correct, but Surinet went to BBN, which went to Genuity, which went to Level 3, and we ended up getting an announcement saying we want our prefixes back. We had just signed an agreement to get some connectivity through Quest, and they gave us four Class Cs. And we had 2 weeks to stop using the other ones. So we didn't have a whole lot of choice about NAT. You know, the NAT was a must. But after we started doing it, it was like, this is not so bad. So we've done the 1918 on the rest of the campus. There's a lot of benefits to just doing that. You can take your internal structure doesn't really matter to what you NAT to on the outside. If you've got web servers scattered across the campus, you can take those and NAT them into a little slash 24 on the outside and say, okay, permit 80 and 443 to this whole subnet, and I'm done. Whereas before, you had to enumerate each individual host where you're allowing those ports in. Did that answer your question?
Jeff, we have a question that came in from the online audience. We only have a couple more minutes. And I hope this isn't a trick question that they're just trying to get me in trouble, but Frank at Westchester University of Pennsylvania asks, how do you handle wireless?
How do we handle wireless?
Is that a whole new presentation or?
let me get back to that previous. You will notice there is an ArubaNet VRF up here. This is where we bring all of our NAPs traffic back to the Aruba controllers. Once they land at the controllers, they can drop into any of the user VLANs they like. I was talking about our addressing scheme using the basically 10.building or routed node or whatever you have. We consider the wireless controllers like a building, so we can duplicate any of the VLANs we have in a building on wireless. We do the same for VPN. if you come in VPN, that's just another, we consider it a routed node.
And we did get one other question. Benjamin Parker from the University of Mount Union asks, are you using the ASA as essentially a zone-based firewall then, such as Palo Alto or Juniper, or would having a zone-based firewall make the implementation easier?
A zone-based firewall. Sure I follow, unless we're looking at DMZ-type zones.
There's a little bit of a lag, so we might not get an answer back from him. But I'll tell you what, we can hook you up by email with them if you'd like.
The ASAs that we have on the edge are strictly just inside to outside. And we do, if you don't have a static NAT in the ASA, you're not going to get any incoming traffic. And if you do have a static NAT, we define the ports that are able to come in. But we're really concerned with only getting from the inside to the outside with the ASAs at that point. We did try looking at overloading either the firewall services module or the ASA to try to do the inner VRF exceptions as well as the inside-outside. And that got to be too big of a headache too quickly. So the ASA is strictly for outside connectivity, and the firewall services module is strictly for VRF to VRF. And it's basically default deny unless you specifically define an inbound subnet and an outbound subnet on the other side. So you can be very specific about those.
All right. Thank you very much. And I want to remind everyone in the room that when you get your evaluations, you'll have a link to all the streamed sessions that we've done for the online conference. So you can watch this one over or any of the other sessions that you might have missed. So you get two conferences for the price of one. So enjoy. Thanks so much, Jeff. It was a great presentation.